Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Thank you, Jeff. Back here on Darren, Donick, and Chase. Always love talking baseball with our next guest. Richard Justice from MLB.com. You can also find him on MLB Network. We say hello and good afternoon to him. Richard, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you guys today?
Oh, we're fantastic. Before we get into this baseball stuff and where it's going and get your opinion on that, I know just from us talking to you over the years, you've always got a story for everything. You have to have a Michael Jordan baseball story, right? I mean, since we've talked so much about The Last Dance.
Yeah, I spent about a week with him in Chattanooga and Birmingham, and what I remembered is what stood out was how quickly he fit into the culture. In the documentary, he says, "I don't have a gambling problem; I have a competition problem," and I saw it every day. He played a round or two rounds of golf in the morning. He came in. He took early batting practice. He then organized card games for his teammates, had lunch catered in, bought them a luxury bus, took regular batting practice, took batting practice after games. I'm one of those that is convinced that if he'd stayed with it, he may have always planned to go back to the NBA because it was clear he was exhausted by it, but that he would have played in the major leagues. He just approached things one step at a time, but, He was a lot of fun to be in, and he did his damnedest to fit in. Later on, when he was in charge of basketball operations for the Wizards, I was assigned to cover him. I was at the Washington Post at the time, and we're out in the hallway outside the locker room one day, and Rod Strickland walks in, and Michael goes, "Rod," and points at his watch, and Rod goes, "Hey, Mike, I've been on time all day, but my car is running like 40 minutes late." I tell you though, he was a joy. He was a joy to be around, and I considered it a privilege to get to know him a little bit, and I got to know him a very little bit. But it was fun seeing. He didn't want a silver spoon. He just wanted to be treated like one of the guys, and that's the way he was treated. He demanded that.
So you think he would have made it to the show? How good would he have been?
Yeah, I don't think he would have been, Christian Yelich or Cody Bellinger, because the clock was ticking on him. But you think about it. That guy walked in off the street, not having played baseball for how long? 20 years? I don't know. And he didn't embarrass himself at Double-A, and he was getting better. Now, they started out throwing fastballs fine, and then they switched to curveballs and changeups, and he was adjusting game by, bit by bit. And those guys, Terry Francona and the hitting coach Mike Barnett, they'll all tell you, like, eventually he was going to make it because he was just one of those guys that never entered his mind, "I'm going to fail." And that's a big part of it. And you take a guy that's playing on the highest level, and then this is true of Tim Tebow too, and he's willing to risk embarrassing himself at something that he has, very little background in. And I remember in spring training I was with him, he was just soaking up the knowledge from the veteran guys. What about this? What about that? But what I remember most of all is how the guys liked him.
Well, we're talking about the minors. Where's this going with the minor league system? How much trouble is it in long term?
Yeah, let's set aside now. This has nothing to do with the shutdown regarding the pandemic. About 2 years ago, one of the first things Rob Manfred did is when he became commissioner 5 years ago, he said, "We're going to put everything on the table in terms of what's the best way to have the game. What's best for the game?" And he put some of the progressive teams, I'm barnstorming here, Astros, Brewers, Orioles, Rays may have been involved. Let's study minor league baseball and figure out what's best for it. And what they came back with is, A, we have too many teams. B, we're drafting too many players. Too many of the facilities are substandard. It's embarrassing, and you don't want to put your players in those facilities. And the travel is ridiculous. Like, if you look at the standings of the Pacific Coast League, you travel basically coast to coast. That's ridiculous. And so what they're going to do is just start over and say, we're going to draft fewer players. We're going to have fewer teams. We're going to pay the players better. We're going to treat them better. But in conjunction with this, now you say, well, Mike Piazza, 52nd round draft pick, wouldn't have a chance. Yes, he would. Because there, for every team, every city that loses a team, there will be independent league teams. And like, I live in Houston, one of the suburban areas, Sugarland, has an independent team that's been pretty successful. And in fact, it has a great ballpark, and I think it's now going to be the Astros AAA franchise. I'm not sure about that, but I think that's in the drawing board because it would make more sense for it. So, but the point is if you have a representative ballpark, there's going to be a plan to get you a team. You just won't be an affiliated team. And players do come out of the affiliated teams. David Peralta, who's a star in Arizona, he washed out as a pitcher and had to come back through the independent leagues and make it that way. So it's going to be a completely different way of doing it, but ideally it's a more efficient way. The reason people are so upset is, well, we've always had a team, we deserve a team, and baseball never did it this way before. That's not a good reason. It's looking at what is the best way to run a minor league system and to run a draft. You know, if you get, basically, somebody told me this last night. I'm not sure this is true. Like, if you basically draft three players, and if you get two players out of one draft, you've had a hell of a draft. Now, you know, I would say to that, Paul Goldschmidt, I think, was an 8th-round pick. Matt Carpenter, 11th round. Alan Craig, 13th round. All those guys. Like, you want those guys to have a chance, too. But that's it. It's just the game is being reshaped, and this is part of the reshaping. But I would say, if anybody tells you, oh, yeah, that guy won't get a chance to play anymore, that's not right. Everybody that can play and has a will to play, there is still going to be a path to the big leagues. It will just be different.
Talking to Richard Justice, MLB.com correspondent. You see him on MLB Network all the time. Richard, it's an interesting take. I guess I hadn't thought about it in those terms, and it hits me hard because I was fortunate enough to play a couple years at those low minor league levels, right. And I have great stories to tell for my whole life, people that nobody's ever heard of, but just great stuff. And so I do think, though, that will there be a price? I guess I'll ask this as a question. Will there be a price to pay for baseball if you have a lot of these teams in these towns that have been there for generations that are no longer there as we know them? Isn't there even though it may not be a great financial play economically, investment-wise, isn't there a value big time for the game and a marketing investment that they will no longer have if they're not affiliated with teams?
Well, I think even the people that run minor league baseball will tell you there are markets that don't deserve a team because they've let the stadium just disintegrate to the point that it's not safe for the players, or it's not what it should be. And the other part of that is surveys have shown, and baseball has surveyed deeply, is that if you've got a team in your town, you really don't care if it's affiliated or not. You know, I mean, Syracuse has always been affiliated as long as I can remember with the Blue Jays. And if you have an independent league team, you still got baseball in your town, and you still got guys that are going to have a chance to play. That's the way I see it. But I think more than that, it's just what is the most efficient way to run this thing? Have we been doing what's best for our franchises? And I think the answer is it's time for some changes.
Well, I hope it works out well because, of course, we all want to see the game succeed on all levels. Richard, let's get to the task at hand here, the negotiations, all of the posturing, the stuff that's getting out that I guess we've become privy to. The part of it is just negotiations, right? You're going to have some back and forth. You're going to have maybe some animosity. Can we get it all worked out by Monday, or are you worried?
No, there's too much. I'm not worried. about losing the season. There's too much risk on both sides. But you do have to understand, I hope people understand, they say, well, the NHL is back. The NBA is moving gradually toward a plan to come back. Those players already made all their money for this season. And the postseason is where the management makes money. In baseball, nobody's collected a check, and there's an unbelievable amount of pain. You know, baseball had $10.7 billion in revenues last year. What's the revenues going to be this year? Even if you ask the players to take a 50% pay cut, there you can box the numbers any way you want to. It's, the loss would be between $2 billion and $4 billion. How much of that pain should the players accept? How much more of the pain? How much should the pain be for owners and all of that? And basically, it's about wrestling with the numbers. Baseball has a long history of doing its collective bargaining in a very public setting. When I was when I would cover, I can 84, 89, 94, all the years I covered baseball labor. 2002, I believe, was the other one. And you would it was all public, and the players would be public about it. You go to the commissioner's office at the end of the day, sit down with him. You go to the union office, sit down with them, and everybody would blast everybody else. Was it the best look for the sport? I wouldn't say it was, but I do say collective bargaining is an honorable endeavor. So the only thing that would worry me is that nothing gets done until we're up against the deadline. And baseball said 25 years of labor peace. But what is the deadline? I mean, I thought today was the deadline, but to get the sport up and going on the 4th of July, we got to do it fast. And, you know, what always happens in these deals, at least for the last 25 years, is there's no chance of making a deal until we make a deal in the last hour and everybody kind of shakes hands and comes out. Literally, the last labor negotiation, it was, I guess, 4 years ago, they were meeting in Irving, Texas. And, I mean, some of the players that I know, like Paul Goldschmidt and those guys, they were very tight-lipped, very like, oh, my gosh, this is tough. And then, like, 2 hours later, you hear them cheering in a meeting, and they come out high-fiving, it's over, we reached an agreement. And that, I assume, I believe, that's what's going to happen again. But this is tough here because we're in waters that we've never been in before. On the other hand, what's the price of at a time when unemployment, we've got 100,000 dead. We've got how many people unemployed? 40 million something. To lose a season over money, especially when you can get ratings that are through the roof because people are so craving something to do that feels normal. The price for losing a season would be pretty high, and I think both sides at the end of the day will understand that. But we're following a familiar path. We're screaming at each other now, and then at some point you make a deal.
Richard Justice is with us from MLB.com. I had a conversation with Tom Glavin a couple of weeks ago when this was all kind of starting, and obviously he was in the middle of things, remembers 94, 2002. I mean, he's been through these negotiations, and his insight on it was very useful. And he made it a point to say, you know, I'm not in there. I'm not privy to this information. But from what I see from the outside, it's obviously a different time and a different situation than what we went through in 94 and 95 that you know, is so talked about. And since, you know, the labor peace has happened since then. And he brought up the fact that the players need to have this thought process of you're probably not going to get paid your full salary because of everything going on and being a reduced season. But at the same time, they have every right to ask the questions about health. They have every right to be weary of a 50-50 split because can they come back from that? So right. do you agree with that way of thinking? And do you think that this is something that if they do have to agree to a 50-50 split or what have you, they would be able to come back from it, or are they going down a road they can't come back from?
Well, let me first say, Tom Glavin is one of the people that saved the negotiations in 2002. We were headed for another work stoppage, and Tommy was one of the guys. There might have been a couple others that flew in and just said, I mean, it was dawn. Like, I remember at a Starbucks in Manhattan at 6 a.m., I saw an NFL official that I knew, an executive, what are you doing here? I said, pointed across the street. I said, baseball labor. And he goes, are they still doing that? He said it in such a condescending way. But I would say it's honorable. And Tommy's one of the guys that came in and said, we cannot have a repeat of 94 and 95. I think I agree with everything he said in that regard. I from the beginning, I thought this is going to be settled by, can we get to the point where the players feel safe? On the other hand, if you're negotiating now the money, that tells me you've reached a point where you think you can come to the health and safety issues on that. One of the compromises the union apparently is willing to discuss is players will take their 50% pay cut and no more, but they will agree to defer the salaries. Now, that upsets some agents who are saying, now, wait a minute, we're probably in for a nuclear winter anyway in terms of payrolls and free agency and all that. So if we roll forward deferred money, does that mean that Mookie Betts is going to get even less, that George Springer is going to get even less? Everything is connected to every other little thing, and there's so many moving targets. But they are talking. They're in regular communication. And, you know, and then people say, you know, I see all these columns and I hear people say, it's a bad look. You got to fix it. Well, that's fine. But we're dealing with billions of dollars. Just there, God is not going to come down and settle this. That this is, men got into this situation and men have to solve it, men and women. And it's just agreeing, finding a number that both sides feel they can live with. It's not that simple. Everybody says, just settle it. Just do it. I mean, they both sides want to just do it, but they want to do it on their terms.
Richard, you brought up ratings earlier and how they could have a possible win in that. And the only examples that I have right now are NASCAR, and they've seen an uptick in their ratings because they're one of the only games in town, and then the match last weekend. So how much do you think the owners and the players look at that data to know that, hey, we have an opportunity here. If we want to come back July 4th weekend and people don't have any sports to attend, I mean, how much do you think they're paying attention to that?
I think they know they would have the stage almost to themselves. They could have the stage almost to themselves. And I think, like what you mentioned, NASCAR and some golf, but I look at the ratings for the Jordan documentary. People were craving something other than cable news. And I just think, you know, the idea, I told somebody the other day, I said, the idea of watching a Clippers-Lakers playoff game, geez, I would pay $20 to see it on my TV. And I think that's the appeal. You get the sport that we miss so much. I mean, I've watched so many of these classic games. I mean, I was like pounding the desk the other day watching a Yankees-Rays playoff game from the last game of the season, and I knew how it came out. Oh, by the way, I've watched the Texas-USC National Championship game about 5 times. And my wife told me, she said, stop tapping your foot. I said, they're down 12 or 4 minutes ago. They can't win.
Did that really happen?
We've seen this movie before.
Like, you still go back and go, wait a minute. What if he had given the ball to somebody other than Lindell White? Whoa.
There's a lot of what ifs, boy. That is fun.
Yeah, that's Pete Carroll's cross to bear, not mine.
Yeah. As we wrap this up, it was good to see Art Hell released from the hospital, as, of course, he tested positive for COVID-19.
One of the true nice guys. You say I got a story for everything. I got a quick story on Art Hell. He and another couple are out in the wine country, and they stop in at this winery run by a little old guy. And they said it was the worst wine ever. It was terrible. And Art felt so bad that he bought a case of it. I think he heard me tell the story on TV or radio or something. I see him like a month later or something. He goes, hey, just to be clear, I did drink that wine. That's Art. He's one of those guys that if you knew him, you played with him, you played for him, you like him. And here in Houston, he was a big part of Astros teams that were really good. He was a successful manager, and he ushered in two guys named Biggio and Bagwell that were pretty influential for both the city and the franchise.
Yeah, they were kind of a big deal. Hey, always a pleasure. You continue to be safe. Always good to talk to you. Thanks for doing this, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Yeah, same to you guys. Thank you.
All right, that is Richard Justice. He is so much fun to talk to. MLB.com, MLB Network is where you can find his work. He's been covering the game of baseball for a long, long time, decades and decades. And as you just heard, basically has a story on everything. Pretty good insight there on a lot of fronts, especially talking about the minor league system that we've talked about today.
Yeah, a take that I really had not considered. I do hope that that is the intent, is to reshape it for the better, but I am a little skeptical. I think Richard has a little bit more optimism. Maybe I have a little bit more heartfelt attachment to the system that's been there. I will admit, and you know, this is kind of a tradition. Like when you go from playing in the SEC, which I did, and you get thrown into the low level of Class A, you do run across some fields and some parks and some facilities where you're like, are you kidding me? Like not just, you know, the infield's not quite as nice, which is the case, but like, okay, guys, here's where you're going to shower after the game before you get on the bus. And you're like, you're not serious, are you? Where are the real showers? That these, you know, it is pretty bad. But it's kind of like a badge of honor after a while. It does test your mettle, your love of the game. And that could use a lot of help, right? But it's almost like that is part of it. So I like the idea of let's do this a different way. But let's not lose the benefits of what happens as a result of the love of the game in these towns, even if it's not the prettiest place. So I would love to meet him halfway. I just hope it doesn't go away. It sounds to me, though, that there is a cost-cutting measure to this. And if it's like, well, there'll just be an independent league. Well, who runs the independent league? You know, and can they make money off of that? How much do the players make? You know, being tied to a team, there is a system, I think, that has worked over time. I'd love to study this. I hope it works out well. But that was a really, really interesting angle by Richard there.
Got to make money. I mean, he's just...
Yeah, so somebody, it's a business. Somebody's got to run the business, right?
So...
Like, could there be a great Nashville independent league or a Middle Tennessee independent league in the absence of single-A baseball? For example, if the Bowling Green Class A League no longer exists, could Bowling Green have a team? Murfreesboro has a team. Huntsville has a team. I'm just thinking out loud of, you know, a regional place where you could run an independent league. Would people go out and support teams like that in those towns? And you could have a good equivalent of Class A baseball. And the players make enough money to keep it going, and maybe I'll get signed by the Mets or the Indians or the Braves.
I think it's extremely difficult.
It'll be hard to start up. But if that's the desire of enough people, that's what I worry about, is the players are going to want to play, right? I have plenty of college teammates who are like, hey, I want to play, man. I just got to find a place to play. I'll go to Evansville. I'll go to Bowling Green. You just tell me where I go. I'll give me a uniform and I'll play. But somebody's got to be providing the business.
Yeah, and if it's the business is losing money, you know, at some point the accountant looks at the business owner and says, here's what you're facing, and you're either just going to keep sinking or you're going to pull the plug and get out from underneath this, because there's a lot of red all over the place on these books. And you open up these books, there's a lot of red, and that's no good, right?
I mean, no, not at all.
And so – I just think it's an extreme – that's why I said at the beginning of the show today, I mean, think about it. There is no other model like this in sports.
Right.
It is the only sport that has this.
Baseball should still want it to preserve.
Oh, I think they do embrace it. But you have to make money. Yeah. That's the point. I mean, I think they do embrace it. That's the reason it's been around for so long. And as Richard said, and you even said, it's been on life support. It's been in dire straits for a long time. This has kind of given them the reason.
But it also thrives if you do it right. I can give you plenty of examples of a small town that built a good park. Bowling Green's a good example. That they have a nice place to watch a game. And if you build a nice place and you run a good program, people are going to come out there, and you do make money. At least I would have to think they do in a lot of places.
Do you know that? I mean, I don't know that. Do you know that? I don't know.
I think there are a lot of places making
Is Bowling Green what, single A?
Yeah, they're class A.
Yeah.
I can't tell you that I know, but I do think that there are great success stories of places that have built a nice facility. I would like to know what has gone on in Jackson, Tennessee with the double A facility that they have. I think we know what has happened triple A wise in Nashville with the building of our new park here. There's been an uptick, right?
I'm not concerned about double A and triple A. I'm concerned about everything below.
Single A. Yeah. No, you're right. Below. Because that's where it's going to hit. That's where the change is probably going to come. So for example, the tennis team at a given university, as great as it might be, let's say it's Georgia or UCLA or Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt's had a great women's tennis program. I would venture to say they're not making money, but somebody along the line thinks it's worth the investment to have scholarship women's tennis, even though year after year they're not going to make money. So baseball, for year after year, they fund minor league players down seven levels, right? That's something that a minor league player walks in. They look on all these fields at spring training. I remember looking, okay, I got to beat out all of these first basemen. And I look down the list. John Olerud, Toronto. Chris Wenke, Knoxville. I mean, just right on down the line. There's seven first basemen that I have to beat out. How am I going to make it? So I get that maybe you don't need seven teams, but there's a reason why the best players emerge and the game is what it is. And part of it is the investment they make in all the players, however small. And what's the residual effect of people following baseball and having a team to root for and keep an eye on, even though maybe you're not making a lot of money at those levels?
I think all these sports would benefit greatly from having long, extensive minor league pipeline. But it's just hard to – the business model shows them that it's just – it's all you're doing is losing money. So these leagues would love to do it, but unfortunately it's a really, really difficult thing to make money off of. And so that's why you don't see this long, extensive pipeline of the minors in the other sports. Baseball has the longest, mm-hmm. and I think that's about to go away, or at least some levels of it. By the way, we had Steve Moulton on in the second hour down in Huntsville. At the time, they were around 464,000. Currently, they've just gone over 492,000, so they're inching ever so closely to their goal of trying to keep that Chargers hockey team and program alive. We will come back and start the fourth and final hour with some trivia, some Friday trivia, next on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.